This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. Your source for Pan-African news and world developments, I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yeis Wu-Heap. Coming up on Africa News Tonight:
movement in Cameroon's two English-speaking regions remains restricted following deadly unrest Sunday as activists took to the streets demanding independence. Local media report as many as a dozen people were gunned down by security forces.
That's Smokey Edwin Kenzeka reporting from the Cameroon city of Bemanda. Details coming up.
Also in Kenya, supporters of opposition leader Raila Odinga demand a change of leadership at the country's election commission. And a 65-year-old Stephen Paddock killed at least 58 people and wounded more than 500 in the U.S. city of Las Vegas.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story: Kenyan police used tear gas and fired shots in the air today to disperse protesters demanding a change of leadership at the country's election commission. The protest took place in the capital, Nairobi, and the opposition stronghold of Kisumu in western Kenya, as well as in the coastal city of Mombasa. The protests were called by opposition leader Raila Odinga, who faces President Uhuru Kenyatta in a rerun of the presidential vote scheduled for October 26th. VOA East Africa correspondent Jill Craig is in Kisumu with the latest on why the protests were called.
Raila Odinga, who's the opposition leader here in Kenya, and he's also a presidential candidate, as most people are aware of by this point, he has called for protests, regular protests, until his demands are met by the Electoral Commission. So in Kisumu today, there were protests which involved lots and lots of roadblocks throughout town. It basically meant that traffic was either non-existent in some places or at a standstill in other places. Youth were carrying signs that Chiloba must go, and Mr. Ezra Chiloba is CEO of the Electoral Commission, the first target by Mr. Odinga in terms of people that he wants to leave the Electoral Commission. Mr. Odinga has said that he, Mr. Chiloba, has colluded with the Jubilee ruling party, and therefore he should resign or be fired. The people today were demanding the resignation or firing of Ezra Chiloba. They were very upset, and many of them were saying that whatever Odinga decides to do in terms of a boycott, which is a threat, boycott of the election, they will boycott if Odinga tells them to, or they will go to the polls on October 26th, that's planned, all based on what Mr. Odinga says.
So is the expectation that these protests and this unrest will continue?
Well, right now we know there are protests today and there are protests scheduled for Friday. Originally we were told they would be weekly, so right now they're semi-sporadic, but it seems like on average they are planned for about once a week. And as many people remember, last year in 2016, during the summer, there were weekly protests to urge the Electoral Commission to be replaced. That did happen. In January, the Electoral Commission was replaced. So these protests do have a history of working. The only difference is that this time around, we are getting fewer and fewer days until that election rolls around on October 26th. So what many people are questioning is whether or not there's going to be time, even if all of Odinga's demands were met, such as the most important one that he says, the Electoral Commission members, commissioners being fired. I mean, if that were to happen, does that leave us enough time to have proper, credible elections by that October 26th deadline? So I think that's kind of the big question that everyone's asking themselves right now.
That was VOA East Africa correspondent Jill Craig. She spoke with me from Kisumu, Kenya.
Movement in Cameroon's two English-speaking regions remains restricted following deadly unrest yesterday as activists took to the streets demanding independence. Local media report as many as a dozen people were gunned down by security forces. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from the city of Bamenda.
An uneasy calm reigned Monday in Bamenda, a city of a half million in northwestern Cameroon. Reverend Edward Njini said just a handful of people came to his morning service.
A few people came by for worship, and then we read the communique from the governor. And so we just prayed with them and asked them to go home and stay and worship at home.
The military was deployed to Bamenda and other towns to stop Anglophone separatist groups from declaring independence on October 1st as threatened. Under government restrictions, no one can enter or leave the northwest and southwest regions of the country. Within those regions, people cannot move outside in groups of more than three. However, on Sunday, tens of thousands of people across the two English-speaking zones defied the restrictions and came out to rally for independence. Separatist groups did not declare independence, but their supporters hoisted the blue and white flag of their would-be nation called Ambazonia in road junctions and some public buildings. They met stiff resistance from the military. A woman shouted for help at Nanga Junction, a neighborhood in Bamenda. She said the military was throwing tear gas and beating people indiscriminately. She told VOA that after a teenage boy was beaten to death, the population blocked roads so military vehicles could not continue to enter the neighborhood. She said those who defied the order to stay at home were being arrested. The government has acknowledged people were killed but did not give figures. The military says at least 40 people have been arrested. In Bamenda, Monday, soldiers continued sealing what they called suspected neighborhoods and arresting more people. In the northwestern town of Kumbu, the government says three prisoners who attempted to escape were killed by the military. The government said the prison had been set on fire by prisoners. Amnesty International says the reports of protesters shot dead by security forces are worrying and urged the government to lift restrictions on freedom of movement and assembly. John Frundi, leader of Cameroon's main opposition political party, the SDF, has condemned the violence.
I don't want bloodshed. I don't want destruction. I've never wanted it. For them to react the way they are reacting is because they've been pushed to the wall.
President Paul Biya responded to the unrest on Twitter and Facebook, saying he strongly condemned all acts of violence, regardless of their sources and their perpetrators, and calling for peaceful dialogue. Back in the capital, Yaoundé, the major towns in the French-speaking regions, rallies are being held to denounce separatist groups. Lawmaker Tabe Tando from the English-speaking Southwest read a declaration at a large rally in Yaoundé Sunday.
The members of parliament outwardly condemn any action aimed at destabilizing our beloved and beautiful country. Reaffirm their attachment to a Cameroon which is one and indivisible, as enshrined in the Constitution. Express their brotherly solidarity to the populations of the Northwest and Southwest regions, victims of the unscrupulous acts of enemies of the fatherland and peace.
The separatist groups say the country's English-speaking minority has been marginalized by French speakers. President Biya has said he is not open to any negotiation on the form of the state and that Cameroon is one and indivisible. Moki Edwin Kinzika for VOA News, Bamenda.
President Donald Trump plans to go to Las Vegas on Wednesday in the wake of last night's mass shooting in Las Vegas. The president praised police and others who responded to the scene to save lives.
In moments of tragedy and horror, America comes together as one, and it always has. We call upon the bonds that unite us, our faith, our family, and our shared values. We call upon the bonds of citizenship, the ties of community, and the comfort of our common humanity. Our unity cannot be shattered by evil. Our bonds cannot be broken by violence.
Police today say 64-year-old Stephen Paddock killed at least 58 people and wounded more than 500 when he shot down at an open-air music concert from a 32nd-floor hotel room. According to police, Paddock apparently killed himself as officers were storming the room. So far, police have not given a motive for the attack, which ranks as the worst mass shooting in modern U.S. history. Paddock apparently resided in the Las Vegas area.
A Libyan suspected of being the mastermind of the Benghazi attack that killed the U.S. ambassador goes on trial today in Washington. Ahmed Abu Katala is charged with 18 counts, including murder, in the 2012 attack. Ambassador Christopher Stevens and three other American employees died in the violence. U.S. Special Operations Forces captured Katala in Libya in 2014. The attack sparked a political storm, with some Republican leaders accusing President Barack Obama and Secretary of State Hillary Clinton of cover-ups and failing to protect the American staff in Libya.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehi Suhib, 16 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. In Kenya, supporters of opposition leader Raila Odinga demand a change of leadership at the country's election commission. And Cameroon's two English-speaking regions remain restricted as activists took to the streets demanding independence. And 64-year-old Stephen Paddock killed at least 58 people and wounded more than 500 in the U.S. city of Las Vegas. And for more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
The UN High Commissioner for Refugees, Filippo Grandi, warns that asylum for people fleeing war and persecution is eroding as states increasingly use refugees as a political football to further their local and national interests. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva at the opening of the UNHCR's annual week-long refugee conference.
The UN Refugee Agency reports a record 65.6 million people were forcibly displaced by war and persecution worldwide at the end of last year, including 22.5 million refugees who had crossed international borders. So far this year, the UNHCR reports more than 2 million people have fled their countries as refugees. In a somber assessment of the current global situation, UN Refugee Chief Filippo Grandi notes in just 5 weeks, 500,000 Rohingya refugees have fled terrifying violence in Myanmar. During the same period, he says more than 50,000 refugees were fleeing South Sudan, 18,000 were escaping fierce clashes in Central African Republic, and the list goes on. Grandi says refugees in some ways always have been used for political purposes, but he adds this seems to have escalated in recent years. He says refugees have become a prominent issue in local and national politics and even in relationships between states.
Protection is constantly being tested, and at times it even seems that refugees have become a commodity traded between states. Principled leadership has frequently given way to an erosion of refugee rights, driven by confused and sometimes frightened public opinions, often stirred up by irresponsible politicians.
Consequently, he says, immigration and asylum measures have become more restrictive, even in previously welcoming countries that have their own histories of exile and migration. High Commissioner Grandi says refugee protection is eroding in many parts of the world, including in industrialized countries. He says the protection environment is deteriorating in traditional countries of asylum in Europe, in the United States, in Australia. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Many South Sudan refugee children living in Uganda refugee camps are struggling to get an education. Most settlements lack the required school facilities. Children study under trees, in open spaces and under tents, but these are still inadequate to match the ever-increasing number of refugees. Reporter Catherine Nambi has more on the story from Kampala.
The majority of South Sudan refugees arriving in Uganda are school-age children. According to the UN Refugee Agency, UNHCR, about two-thirds of the refugees are under the age of 18. Most of them have high aspirations for their future once they complete their education. 11-year-old Abdusalam Dieng is a South Sudanese refugee in Ayilo, a settlement primary school in Adjumani district.
I want to be a president so that I change the lifestyle of South Sudan, so that there is no war. Two, I want to be a doctor so that I treat people. Our doctors were being killed in South Sudan because of nothing, and we ran here to be as refugees.
However, the dreams of Dieng and other South Sudan refugee children in Uganda settlements are at risk due to lack of teachers as well as learning facilities and space. Bulgarang Gabriel is an education assistant in Nyumanzi refugee settlement in Adjumani district.
You get the ratio of a teacher is 1 to 150. There are few classes that are available nowadays school year. Those few classes are there, but they are also lacking desks for sitting, in which one desk is supposed to accommodate 3 children. And here you get the population, the enrollment of this school is about 1,583. That population, compared with the 9 classes that we have, you find that most children, they learn when they are open at the window of the house, because the room cannot accommodate them.
The children who do get a primary education, however, do not make it to higher school levels. That is because there are few or no secondary schools in the camps. Inido Cheng is a senior protection officer with UN Refugee Agency.
We find a larger number of children passing their primary school but are unable to proceed to secondary school because of lack of resources. In this context, we have minimal number of secondary schools compared to the numbers that are currently attending primary school. And above all, there's also the provision of the need for scholarships to be able to sustain them. And again, scholastic materials are all required. And all this boils down to issues of resources. So overall, we are really urging the international community and donors, private funders, to come to our support, given the large numbers that we are receiving.
Education assistant Bulgarang says the absence of secondary schools is responsible for the crime in the settlements because many children are left idle.
They don't have anywhere to go and study in secondary school. So for them, whenever they are lacking school, they decide of what to do, whether bad or good, that's what they should just do at their free time. So it is a challenge to the community. All the cases that are solved in the settlement here are mainly because of secondary school students who are lacking space in secondary school. So we propose a secondary school, actually, if they can put secondary school up in the label of refugee settlement.
Stanley Misileni is the head of the UNHCR office in Adjumani. He says the South Sudan refugee children in Uganda camps need a complete education since they are the ones to remodel and redevelop South Sudan.
Not providing adequate education is a major, major concern, because this is the generation for South Sudan, which if they do not earn skills at this time whilst in asylum, what will happen? Can you just imagine what would happen upon return and reintegration in the country of origin? So we do need education as one area to uplift the standards of the refugees.
Currently, children in many refugee settlements in northern Uganda rely on voluntary teachers to gain whatever education they can get. This is Catherine Nambi for VOA News in Kampala.
Achieving gender equality and empowerment for all women and girls is a key element of the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals. VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with Katya Iverson, President and CEO of Women Deliver.
Girls and women have so much power and potential, and when you invest in them, there's a ripple effect and everybody wins. But their health, well-being and rights have been under-prioritized in many countries across the globe.
So why is being here at UNGA something that will further their interests and therefore affect the world?
UNGA brings together world leaders from every country in the world. And if you want to talk to many at the same time, this is easy if you can navigate it. This year, Women Deliver has 15 young people from across the globe in town. And we work with them to have discussions with their leaders and really call attention to that young people are not just the leaders of tomorrow, they are leaders of today, and the world needs to invest in them.
Now, I understand you have this focus on adolescents. What do they need? What do they bring to the table?
Looking at young people and adolescents in terms of health, in terms of education, in terms of participation in the family, in communities, is very important. Imagine being a 15-year-old girl when so many things happen in your body, in your school, in your life. It's such an important age in terms of good habits and what they can, what they learn, what they want to be, their hopes, their dreams, their opportunities.
And their challenges.
And their challenges. Many places, they are married already when they are 15, they are already mothers. And the leading cause of death for girls between 15 and 19 years old is dying in pregnancy or childbirth.
Where?
Across the globe. But we see the highest rates of maternal mortality among adolescent girls in West Africa. And we also see girls not having any say in their family, any say in their own life, and being considered as a commodity. Women Deliver works to empower young people to live healthy lives and have, for example, access to health clinic where they can be treated properly and not put aside, not sit in a public room if they have to talk about something confidential, including their body and sexuality.
How do you negotiate the balance between the traditional cultural norms that they have and this other way of looking at women and girls that you promote? You seem to have a sense of urgency about a shift.
The best advocates for adolescent girls and adolescents in general are adolescents themselves and young people.
Why should they be given a voice?
Because it's their lives. Getting young people to the decision-making table, whether it's about policies or whether it's about programs or activities or investments, they need to be there because that will make the policies and programs much more efficient. We see great example of young people and adolescents organizing themselves to get a collective voice.
I understand that adolescent boys as well as girls are getting into the swing of this self-empowerment and making sure their voices are heard.
Sure. We see young men from the communities talk to the elders in the communities about how they don't want child marriage anymore, how they don't want their sisters to be married off, and how they don't want to marry somebody way young but want somebody equal. We see young people in Nigeria organize around being able to learn about their own bodies, getting sexuality education, and pushing that themselves so it now is getting into the curriculum of the schools that not only do you need to hear about biology, but you also need the other aspect. We need to look at girls and women not as victims and vulnerable, but as powerful and really key agents in driving the progress in communities, in countries, and globally.
That was Katya Iverson, President and CEO of Women Deliver. She spoke with VOA's Adam Phillips at the United Nations in New York.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports coming up at 18:30 UTC. On behalf of our producer, Kwame Ofori, and our engineer, Wagner Roberts, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
This is a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
How much do you know about HIV, the virus that causes AIDS? Do you know that you cannot get HIV from toilet seat or a drinking glass? HIV is transmitted through blood and bodily fluids, primarily through sexual contact. One way to protect yourself if you are sexually active is to be sure to use a condom. Condoms can reduce the risk of getting or transmitting HIV by up to 98%.
That was a message in the public interest from VOA.